Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the theme, who is controlling the narrative on democracy, civil rights, race, and the sovereignty of our bodies and the choices, the freedom to make a choice of what goes into our body, whether it's a food or a vaccine. My guest, Danny Sheehan from Santa Cruz, California. Danny is one of our nation's most important and influential constitutional and public interest lawyers. During the past 45 years, he has handled such public interest cases as the Pentagon Papers, the Watergate break-in, Iran-Contra, and the Silkwood murder case. He has represented victims of Three Mile Island nuclear disaster and fought against the American Nazi Party on hate crimes. He has been a lead attorney on behalf of the Native Nations at Standing Rock, and handling the dismantle of the federal case against Chase Iron Eyes for inciting a riot and felony trespassing. Danny is the founder of the Romero Institute, a nonprofit public policy center in Santa Cruz, California. And more recently, he founded the New Paradigm Institute, which explores new pathways to world peace. He holds a law degree and divinity degree from Harvard University. He is the author of The People's Advocate, The Life and Legal History of America's Most Fearless Public Defense Lawyer. His websites are Daniel P. Sheehan, SHEEHAN.com, Daniel P. Sheehan, and RomeroInstitute.org. He is joined in New York City by Mary Holland, J.D. She is the General Counsel and Vice Chair of the Board for the Children's Health Defense Fund, founded by Robert Kennedy Jr. and a former law scholar at the New York Area Law School, specializing in international human rights, public law, vaccine safety law, and injury compensation. She also has a son who regressed into autism following the MMR vaccine. Mary holds a degree in Russian studies from Harvard and graduate degrees in international relations and a JD degree from Columbia University. She also co-founded the two nonprofits, the Elizabeth Burt Center for Autism Law and Advocacy and the Center for Personal Rights. Mary is the co-author of Vaccine Epidemic, about corporate greed and bad science behind the vaccine industry. Her most recent book is The HPV Vaccine Trial, Seeking Justice for a Generation Betrayed, the most concise book behind the history and adverse effects of the human papillomavirus vaccines such as Gardasil, with a preface by the Nobel Prize winner in medicine, Dr. Luc Montagnier. The website for the Children's Health Defense Fund is childrenshealthdefense.org. Nice to have both of you on our program today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gary.
The major discrepancies between the scientific facts about the virus, the COVID virus, and the pandemic, and human rights issues involving that, and the political policies being enacted. And originally, as a scientist, public health science, my doctorate is in human nutrition and public health science, and for 33 years as senior research fellow at the Institute of Biology, I look at scientific studies a little differently than the average person in the media or a lay person. I looked very carefully, and what I was seeing was conflation of those who were dying from normal end-stage diseases, end-of-life diseases such as emphysema, coronary heart disease, or congestive heart failure, cancer, etc., dementia, and those dying specifically from COVID-19. They were both loaded in together. So I felt, well, why are they doing that? Clearly, people within the public health community, especially epidemiologists, will see that this is not giving us an accurate picture. But then it got worse. We were told, with hundreds of different tests being given around the world, almost all those test kits were shown to be limited or simply junk. Then we were told, okay, we have to have a national policy and then a worldwide policy. In effect, quarantine, keep people at home, young and old, sick and well together. and that turned out to be a disaster. Then we were told, well, the best test to take is the PCR test. Now, I happen to know the inventor of that test, Dr. Kerry Mullis. I filmed him and interviewed many times, and he said, do not use the PCR test to determine a viral load or as a diagnostic measure. It does neither. And he won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1993 for discovering that. But still, we're using the PCR test with its fallacies, and also it gives a high degree of false positives or false negatives, and it doesn't distinguish a current active virus from one you've had 5 years ago. You could have had a cold 2 years ago and suddenly show positive, but you're asymptomatic because you're healthy. Your doctor will say, this is a COVID case. Now, what's dangerous about all this is we've had thousands of scientists within the world community, respected men and women, come forward and say, we're getting a lot of this wrong. And what they didn't like was the policies, the draconian policies being implemented all over the world. And my concern is not to have you address these specific scientific issues, but rather address the legal issues, the constitutional issues, if any exist to protect the public, and if so, what? Because now in New York State, the New York State Bar Association has recommended to the governor that he can go ahead and mandate the coronavirus vaccine because he is constitutionally protected. He can do that. Well, what's the average person to do who, for whatever reason, says, I don't want that experimental vaccine in my body? Do I have any rights? In Australia, they're saying, no, you do not. It's a 5 years in prison or a $66,000 fine if you choose not to take it. In Denmark, they just stopped the parliament from enacting something of a similar draconian nature. And now major magazines, including the New England Journal of Medicine, is saying, if you are anti-vax, and it doesn't matter if you have good science, if you have truth, if you have life experience, no matter what your reason, you are a danger to society, and therefore there should be a price to pay for refusing vaccine. The latest effort that I just saw was one where they're willing to take individuals and take them off food stamps unless they get the vaccine. So the science is now showing the discrepancies between the official word and what the policies are, and the official policies are driven by people like Bill Gates saying, the world will not come back to normal until every single person on the planet is vaccinated at least twice. Fauci is backing this. The White House, no matter who's in the White House, backs this. The CDC, the FDA backs it. Most of the scientific community, medical community are backing it. Well, who's backing the public? That is where we begin. And let us start with you, Mary. Please lay out your argument about what has happened to our rights and where have these rules overstepped the boundaries, the constitutional provisions. The form is yours.
Thank you, Gary. So we at Children's Health Defense are backing the public. We are not backing sort of the digerati, the 1% that is pushing this great reset through vaccines and the surveillance that goes along with it and the multi-trillions of dollars to go up to these people at the top. We're standing firmly for people's God-given rights, people's right to free exercise of religion and free expression and the right to assemble and the right to petition the government with grievances and the right to prior free and informed consent. And Robert F. Kennedy Jr. recently gave an inspiring speech where he said, you know, I will meet you at the barricades and I will die with my boots on. We see this as absolutely a threat to everything we hold dear. This is a threat to democracy. It's a threat to our children. It's a threat to our health. It's a threat to our spirits. And we will not sort of stand by and do nothing. And you mentioned Denmark, Gary. I really think that we have to look at that as an enormous success and what it will take. So in Denmark, the parliament was looking at a new law that would have allowed use of the military to actually strap people down and force vaccinate them. And people got out on the streets for 9 straight days. And that law has just vanished into the ether. It's gone. There's no question that the populace, the public, can defeat these draconian measures if they stand up and act and make it clear that they will not comply with these unjust and unconstitutional measures.
As a follow-up, what do you suggest we do? How do we start this process?
So we at Children's Health Defense are all about education. We put out a newsletter every day called The Defender. I recommend that people sign up. They give an email address, and being informed is number one. Joining a health freedom or a sort of constitutional rights group in your state, joining with others who are like-minded. I don't think we're going to win this without, frankly, being in the streets. I think that is proving to be very challenging, but I think people are doing that the world over, and we can see that it is having an impact. It is having an impact. I think reaching out to elected officials, we just went through an election in New York, Gary. On the people who endorsed the repeal of the religious exemption, a disproportionate number of those people have been voted out of office. I think, you know, there's a number of pressure points. I wish that we weren't in the situation that we're in, but I don't want to convey the message to people that it's hopeless and that we're powerless. Those are simply not true. We do have power, and actually part of the narrative that I hope that we'll talk about today is obviously that this 1% that's pushing this sort of reset, they are quite fearful of people who are not willing to vaccinate. They are quite fearful of the people who are standing up and saying, no, we will not comply. I think they're actually telegraphing to us that we do have power and that we have to learn how to use it effectively by unifying, by having international strategies. But they are letting us know they consider us to be a very serious threat. Vaccine hesitancy, according to the World Health Organization, is one of the top 10 public health threats in the world. So just to say that I think it's not going to be easy, Gary. I expect that the situation will become more challenging in the months ahead as these vaccines come out and there is significant public pressure to get people to get them. But we're not hopeless. We're not powerless. I do believe this can be derailed, as has happened in the past with anthrax vaccines, with swine flu vaccines, with the H1N1 vaccine. These things can and have been derailed.
Good. Thank you. Danny, this past Friday, there was this statement. Americans who refuse to get mandated COVID-19 vaccinations may lose benefits such as food stamps and rent assistance, according to a document from John Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health Center for Health Security. According to the document, one of the top members of the working group of Reading Populations for COVID-19 Vaccines is Luciana Borio, medical doctor, a prominent member of Joe Biden's COVID-19 task force. What does it tell you when we're threatening tens of millions of people who receive food stamps for themselves and their children? There are over 17 million hungry children who are food insecure, that if you don't take the vaccines, and there's two that are coming immediately, with a few about 3 weeks apart, and totally experimental, then we might cut off your rent assistance. We might take away your food stamps. It means you're going to starve and be on the streets. What does it say when people in any administration, I would also put that the Trump administration would be no better at this, when they're threatening the very existence of people to take the vaccine or else? Your thoughts, please.
Well, this is an extraordinarily interesting an important constitutional issue, as you've indicated. As the co-founder of the Harvard Civil Rights Law Review back in 1968, and the former president of the Fund for Constitutional Government in Washington, I view all of these things through a very specific prism of the Constitution and what sources of authority the federal government and through the Bill of Rights and the states through the imposition on the states of the 14th Amendment of these restrictions on fundamental authority of government that were imposed on the newly created federal government by the Constitution. It's important to understand that the federal government was created as a very specifically limited government, a government of power. And it was specifically understood that at that time, at the origins of this in 1789 and 91, that the state governments were the ones that were invested with more general elements of sovereignty. That changed, of course, with the 14th Amendment. And the strict constructionists argue that the 14th Amendment and its equal rights provisions and equal protection provisions really only apply to members of the Negro race, arguing that that this was a product of the Civil War and that it was fought solely for the purposes of giving equal rights to the black race that had been enslaved. And we, on the other side of this, the progressives, have argued that, in fact, the limitation on the authority of government, the federal government through the Bill of Rights, the 14th Amendment, and the state governments, really is a process of recognizing pre-existing fundamental human rights that are a function, basically, of natural law. And that there has been this dialectical conversation going on since the very origins of our country and our Constitution. And what we see happening here is the confrontation between these two different views of the Constitution, and that the progressives are arguing that we as citizens have a right not to have restrictions placed upon us by the authorities. And as we know, the elite have seized control and have always maintained control over both state and federal government agencies. That what the fundamental issue here is one of dividing the factual assertions that are being made into a category to figure out what some of those facts are, because some of these, the ones that you've listed, for example, Gary, are clear, narrowly drawn facts that are contradictory to some of the basic postulates that are being asserted on the part of the elite, on the part of the government authorities, on the part of the governors and the Biden administration with regard to this vaccine issue. So there needs to be a much more intense focus on the factual assertions that are being made here. Because it's perfectly clear to me, who have been a progressive my entire legal career of 50 years here, is that I'm in favor, generally, of the governmental institutions doing things to help people, which include the examples you point out, giving people food stamps, providing people with rent assistance and all that. But these are not fundamental rights. These are not anything that has been recognized as being within the scope of the federal government. Somehow the federal government was created to provide these types of services to people. And so the challenge of making the argument that these accesses to government services are somehow fundamental rights to which we're entitled is something that has to be looked at much more closely by the progressive community, because what we're getting ready to face, I think, with the Biden administration and the pro-vaccination people, is what they're going to be doing is not saying that the military is going to be sent in to strap you down and force you to take these vaccinations. What they're going to be threatening to do is to suggest that you do not have access to these certain privileged statutory programs unless you have been given the vaccine. And so that's a different type of argument. And it's one that I think we in the progressive community and in the civil rights community have to really closely examine in order to not be just, tilting at windmills here from a constitutional point of view. that until such time as they argue that they're going to strap you down and forcibly give you this, the only grounds on which one can make an argument that you're being discriminated against and being provided these programs of food stamps or rent assistance or Medicare or whatever the things, all these services are, that unless you're being discriminated against on the grounds of your race or your religion or your political views, if you're not being discriminated against on the basis of those, you're not going to be entitled to what we call the strict scrutiny test of looking at the exercise of government power and placing checks on the exercise of such power. If in fact there's any kind of legitimate government interest being promulgated in support of them providing these kind of restrictions on who can get access to public services, et cetera, unless we can show that there's no legitimate government interest at all, we're not going to be able to meet that test. They're going to actually argue that there's a compelling government interest because of this epidemic. That needs to be challenged on the factual side of the ledger. So that, in my opinion, is that there's a lot of focus that's being directed toward these facts, but we need a lot more in that area, because what we see is that in this age of intense tribalization, the 99% of the people on either side of this particular debate, the pro-vax or anti-vax arguments, is that people are believing information without real access to any of the underlying information. So there's a major public education campaign that needs to be undertaken following an intense analysis of what the facts are here. I've sat down and I've had beginning conversations with Robert Kennedy Jr. I spent an entire evening with him at his home and dinner with him discussing some of these things. And I need to look into this a lot more to be able to ascertain what facts are really established and which ones are not. But from the point of view of the constitutional side of the ledger, the legal requirements here, We have to be very clear in distinguishing what the fundamental rights are that individual people have versus access to these privileges, these access to these statutory provisions or these programs that are, in a certain sense, gratuitous on the part of the federal government and even the state governments. That's just a fundamental point that I want to make here. And if there's only one simple fact information and law that I can get set forth here, this one. We need to make a clear distinction between those types of public services and things that are actual fundamental rights that we have pursuant to natural law. And we have a natural law right not to be forced to take a vaccine, invade our body, insert these vaccines into us that threaten our DNA, that have all these experimental aspects of them of influencing the actual internal dynamics of your DNA system functioning. Those are profound and fundamental rights, which I've argued in a number of different cases, all the way from Eisenstadt versus Baird, where I argued the case at the Harvard Civil Rights Law, which went on to the Supreme Court, of unmarried people having a right of access to birth control, that the state cannot exercise its power to prohibit you from getting access to birth control information or services. And it's gone all the way through the Pentagon Papers case, all the way up to the Supreme Court, and all of this, the Karen Silkwood case. I've done all these cases, and I'm just trying to make clear to the progressive community that we have to be very clear about the distinction that exists between the protection of those profound and important fundamental rights, not to have our internal body invaded involuntarily, from okay. access to these programs.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. Mary, there's a lot of moving pieces here, and I'm going to break down what the actual science, the real science, not the corporate science, not the propaganda coming out of the New York Times, but we look behind the scenes. Richard Gale and myself go all the way back to the origins of where something started to see, is it true what we're seeing or is it just propaganda? And then I'm going to go through some of what the actual real science shows. Then based upon what Danny just said, we're going to have an argument based upon what does the real science show, and then a propaganda campaign or an educational campaign to get our message out. And all of this has to be done in light of the fact that we do not have the mass media. We do not have social media. Facebook now has gotten Wikipedia as its official fact checker. And as you know, I've written 72 articles excoriating the lack of authenticity in anything involving health, or for that matter religion, or for that matter politics, that they stand for. And we're in the process of preparing lawsuits, and we'll be filing those in the next 3 weeks, to take our issue to court. But we've never had anything that we've written in 72 articles and 14 letters to their legal department and their board shown to be an error. So we don't have Wikipedia. They'll work against us. We don't have Facebook. We don't have Twitter. And we don't have Google. They'll work against us. YouTube will deplatform a person. And then you have the sock puppets and the shame masters who come out to shame every single person. But we don't have that. So we have to think much more diligently about what we can do. Now, here's what we do have on our side. Right now, the leading Nobel Prize winning persons in the world involved in epidemiology, including an MD, PhD from Yale, who's published 300 papers in the peer-reviewed literature, impeccable credentials, says, that, for example, that more than 55 studies in the peer-reviewed literature shows that hydroxychloroquine work in combination with zinc and azithromycin, an antibiotic, especially in the first 7 days. It doesn't work later when they're in intensive care, and that's where they used it and came up with high potencies up to 9,000 milligrams, and patients died. But at 200 to 400 milligrams, some doctors say 100% of their patients get well in the first 7 days. So therefore, if we, and this is just information for you, but it's solid information, we have thousands of doctors, board certified, coming forward now, joining groups like America's Frontline Doctors. Started with about 5 people, now it's got over 1,000. These people didn't know each other. They all come from regular backgrounds, and they're angry because they're saying, we don't need a vaccine. We don't need a $3,200 medication that Moderna is making. We can do this with an inexpensive, safe, and effective FDA-approved pharmaceutical that's been around 65 years. That's one argument. So the whole argument that we must vaccinate, all of our policies are against you if you don't vaccinate, and you should be punished. The New England Journal of Medicine suggested punishment against anyone who refuses vaccination. So we do have the science on our side as far as saving lives. Secondly, they say that it doesn't matter what happens, you must wait until the vaccine, and yet we know that 90% of all the people who've died from coronavirus died because of comorbidities. They were at the end of their life. In fact, in Italy, in Spain, and in other countries, they actually had been at the very end, 80, 81 years of age, which was actually a year longer than normal lifespan. They were in assisted living, hospice care, or nursing homes. Those are the people who died, but there were no autopsies determined that they died because of COVID or with COVID or not with COVID at all. And now later, when they are reviewing these deaths and reprogramming to a more accurate system, they're finding that a lot of people died who were called COVID that weren't, probably as many as 90%. The CDC's own statements just a few weeks ago said that only 6% of all deaths can be attributed exclusively and by itself to COVID virus. That means 93 to 94% of the deaths are not. That suddenly makes it no longer a pandemic, no longer needing state, city, or national policies, draconian policies, or police state powers or executive powers to cause lock-ins and closing down businesses, etc. So we have that science, and it's not just a few people or a few studies. It's a lot of people speaking out. And all these people put themselves at risk. Just on today's program, I interviewed one of the world's leading MD scientists, 50 years, 5-0, in the field, head of department, and a major university in Germany, publishing hundreds of peer-reviewed journals, not a single controversial thing in his life. And his wife, who's in oncology, said, you must speak out. We cannot allow bad science, political science, and commercial science to dictate what we're going to do here. We're being lied to. And he said because of her anger and outrage that he became involved and risked his career to go on online and say that if you look at the death certificates around the world, the deaths from COVID and the deaths from normal deaths, including influenza, there's no bump. In fact,
Gary, could I ask a question? Can you tell me this debate that, as far as I can tell, keeps kind of going? What is the fundamental underlying reason why people are asserting that this elite is doing this? It keeps on seem to me tracking back to this, you know, Rockefeller Institute Foundation, that they're trying to get control over everyone. There's some sort of secret agenda.
Why? Yeah, they are lying. They are out and out lying. I've been saying this from the very beginning.
Yes.
We acknowledge the virus is real. That's not in dispute. We acknowledge it can kill people. That's not in dispute. But who it's killing and how they're killing it, I'll finish this off, and then Mary will address this.
Yes.
Also,
okay.
we're finding out that just yesterday, there was a report released by the British Medical Journal showing that the tests they were using were giving false positives, but they hit it. In the United States, the FDA was giving a false positive test, and then threatened two states, including Nevada, and Arizona, don't let this out, or you'll be punished. So the tests we're using are not accurate. There's no gold standard test. So all these tests are not being done by a gold standard. And also the New York Times, I'm holding a particular disdain, because every day the front page headlines in the New York Times, 105,000, 120,000, whatever it is, new cases. A case is determined by the number of symptoms and the state of a person's health. It is not and should never be determined by testing positive on a very inaccurate test. They've conflated it. If you want to say this amount of people tested positive but are otherwise asymptomatic or healthy, fine. And these are the number of people tested positive but are manifesting two or more of the symptoms, that's fine. They've conflated it to keep the numbers up. The numbers of death have gone down. In other countries, they're down to one or two or zero per day, and no one's paying attention to this. And finally, virtually all the thousands of doctors and scientists coming forward at great risk have all been shamed. Many have been threatened, including two of the top epidemiologists at Stanford University, and to try to retract their statements. And yet the only two statements that have been retracted were from the New England Journal of Medicine and The Lancet, where they attacked hydroxychloroquine and said it shouldn't be done. And those both were showed to be fraudulent studies, had to be retracted. And retracting an article in those two journals is really something unprecedented. And so therefore we're left with, why in the world would you attack a drug that is so inexpensive, about 19 cents per pill, about $200 for full treatment at low potencies, 200 to 400 milligrams a day. Why would you do that and promote a $3,200 drug made by Moderna when it's shown in its own study, including the World Health Organization, showed it didn't work? It's not helping people, and it has serious side effects. So this is the politics of it. So the science is on our side, Mary, independent, high-quality science. We have thousands of people willing to testify. They have all been attacked. Not one of them has been spared, no matter what their background. And yet the official line is still carried. Could you address these, please?
Yeah, Mary, is this being done, we believe, just to massively make money for these people, which is no surprise?
No.
Something worse happening?
Yeah, I think it's so to address you, Gary, and Danny, your question. So I think what you're pointing to, Gary, is the science, it doesn't add up, right? Hydroxychloroquine seems to work. Vitamin C, vitamin D, zinc, eminent scientists, Ioannidis, Cahill, Bakhti, eminent DDA Raoul, eminent scientists around the world are stepping up at great personal risk to say, it just doesn't add up. There are good, cheap drugs. We don't need a vaccine. It's not a pandemic. We don't need an experimental vaccine. We don't need to be there. There was funny business with the recordings of deaths for flu versus COVID versus comorbidities. The PCR test, as you've pointed out, Gary, it's not accurate. It's not testing infection. It's testing positive DNA sequences that don't necessarily in any way correlate to infectivity. So it just, and as you point out, the only two retractions in this whole period of time since January were in the New England Journal and The Lancet because they falsified the data related to hydroxychloroquine large-scale clinical trials, and people died. People died from having been given four times what was the therapeutic dose. So it doesn't add up. Why are we doing this? Is it really based on the science? And I think we can say clearly it's not based on good science. So what is going on, to go to Danny's question? And I think we really can see that the global elite, and I think one can look to particularly the World Economic Forum and to the UN in setting sustainable development goals, have articulated now for a long time that by 2030, they want every person on the planet to have a unique identity. They want this person to have a unique biometric identification. And so the question then becomes, how could they achieve this? How can they get that kind of global record keeping for each individual? And I think one of the things that is clear is that you can do that through a massive vaccination campaign. It's possible. We know another goal of the World Economic Forum and Bill Gates and those that he sort of, you know, represents, they want to move to a cashless society. They want to move to a global financial regime where everything is tracked. There's a kind of cryptocurrency world where there's no such thing as a non-transparent financial transaction. They want governments to be able to see into every financial transaction. How can you do that? Well, you can do that towards moving people away from in-person transactions and have everything be online. Shopping online, medicine online, education online. Everything that is online is surveilled. It is something that is transparent to the big tech companies and who they are in partnership with governments. So, and I don't mean to make it sound like it's a secret pact. I don't think it's secret. I think it's called the Great Reset. That's kind of a repackaging of something called the Fourth Industrial Revolution. These are things that have been talked about in elite circles of big data, big pharma, big biotech, big government. They've been deliberated on for a very long time. And I think what we see is that this COVID pandemic, as it is being called, is now being heralded by these powers that be as this fantastic opportunity for the Great Reset to build back better. And, you know, yes, this may be a terrible sort of tragedy, but isn't this wonderful that now we're going to be ready for the next pandemic and we're going to be online and we're going to have these, you know, identities for each of these people. I think that that's the only way that I can understand what's going on, because I think, as you point out, Gary, the science just doesn't add up. There aren't such spectacular excess deaths. There just aren't. These are comorbid. Most of the people who've died are people who are at the end of life. It's not saying that there's not a virus. There is a virus. There was, that people can die from it. But has it been a pandemic? Is this like smallpox? Is this the kind of thing that justified the emergency laws that are still basically casting their shadow today? No, this is not smallpox. Smallpox killed between 15 and 30% of any person who became infected. That is absolutely not COVID, where 99, 98% of people survive. So we can't justify what's happening based on the science that we know.
We have all read the original report by the founder of the World Economic Forum. He's been around a long time. In fact, he was around when the Gorbachev Foundation was founded also. We read what he had to say, and here's the danger of this. Part of the fourth industrial revolution seems, at least the exterior part, to be beneficial for some people. There'll be a lot of debt forgiveness. There'll be a lot of the ability to travel anywhere in the world without having the normal type of visas and passports, as if the world opens itself up. But we also won't have to worry about all the elections we have, because there'll be a different way of selecting the individuals who will be in control of sectors of the population. Now, when I look at this, and Richard Gell and I have had really deep discussions on this, I say what I see is, like everything else that's sold to the public, it's sold with a sugar lining to it. But look deeper. It means, like China. China now has everyone under constant 24/7 surveillance. Anything you say over telephone or computer, anything that you do on the street, anything you do in a public place immediately is judged, and they evaluate you on a scoring system. So let's just say that you jaywalked, Danny, in Peking. Yeah. You get on a plane an hour later. Every single phone on that plane will light up, showing your face that you're on the plane and you should be shamed and not spoken to because you no longer have the same social mm-hmm. credit as someone else. You have to mm-hmm. adhere, and you're rewarded. And the reward is you're given certain opportunities in life. If you and you cannot, for example, with an identity card, which is now being called the vaccine passport, on that passport will be all the information about you. Now, in the vaccine that they're giving that ties into the card, the vaccine is not a normal jab in the arm with a single dose intramuscular. Instead, it is on a Band-Aid-looking strip with multiple little needles with a particular type of technology that's never been used, first time ever, and it'll send millions of tiny little nanoparticulate matter, all of which are communicating with an outside source and getting information back from that same source. Once that's in your body, you can't get it out. Now, we don't know what it's going to be telling the body, nor do we know all the information it'll be retrieving about us and sending back to the body. But that's what they want. They want us to feel good that we don't have to worry about getting on a plane, going into a movie, going to a ball game, going to a dance, getting on a subway. All that now will happen automatically because you don't even have to show your card. You just go up and there's a light material under the skin because of this, and your hand is your passport in. It's your identity card in. So you can do anything. But now they're talking about in the fourth industrial revolution, oh, and we're going to make all food no longer do you have to pay cash. Then we get rid of all cash. That means all gold, silver, cash, coins, bitcoins, everything is gone. Your money will be given to you in an account, and you'll be given, depending upon what you do in society, what work or anything else, everything goes into account that they control. You're given credit for that, so when you want to buy something, you just pass your hand over, and that is deducted like a debit card from your account. But you have social credits, political credits, ideological credits. This is all part of what we're going to be seeing, because once you open that Pandora box to allowing unfettered access to our body and our DNA, then you no longer have the same rights as a citizen otherwise. So I see this as even deeper. Mm-hmm. I see this mm-hmm. as by a group of individuals acting in complete transparency. They've been discussing this stuff for years, not just right now. It's not a hidden cabal. It is the Davos Group, and one of the leading people in the Davos Group is the man who created the World Economic Forum, because they want one world government. David Rockefeller wanted that. They want one world government. They want one ultimate authority in every region of the world for every single thing, all controlled by the Internet of Things. And that's why 5G is being promoted, because it will connect everything and everyone to this grid. Now, they will control your car. They will control everything in your life. Do you really want that? That is the larger issue. Mary, am I addressing that very accurately? Yeah.
I think you are. Klaus Schwab is the name of the person, and I think it's relevant, Gary, that he grew up in Nazi Germany. I mean, I think it is a very sort of, it's a hybrid kind of a fascistic, communistic vision of the future. It is not one rooted in our Bill of Rights, that's for sure. It is not about individual rights at all.
Okay.
Thank you. Danny, over to you.
So that's where I thought this was going. This is a variation on the secret chip, right? This basically being inserted into everyone's body covertly by this vaccine that is going to be used as what you point out, Gary, as the secret monitor that is able to do this thing like in China to keep every single social credit, ethical credit, everything to be able to control. This is the secret chip argument, right?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So that's a fact question that really needs to get focused on, it seems to me, by the progressive community. On this side of the ledger, the fact ledger, this seems to have a substantial amount of factual support. That I've been being sent, you know, all the videos by this guy, Klaus Schwab, and the Rockefeller report, you know, the foundation report, there's an argument that is a consistent argument that seems to be available here for evaluation, which would be what we refer to in trial terms as a Rule 11 preliminary investigation, that prior to crafting any complaint is going to be lodged, setting aside the problem of the objectivity of the court that you're trying to deal with, but to set forth a chronology of facts, detailed support with documented support on what it is that's going on, to assert that the reason that at the Christic Institute and the Romero Institute we've been as successful as we've been over the last 50 years in winning these cases that nobody thought you could do is because we're willing to do the kind of detailed investigation as part of a Rule 11 preliminary investigation is necessary. And then you can set forth a choreography of facts that you can support and show are true that lead to a reasonable conclusion that you're arguing. And then number two, you need to have a legitimate cause of action that set of facts, if proven to be true, will in fact entitle you to relief on. So this is the process that needs to be followed by the progressive community in order to confront this particular challenge that we're talking about here. And so the real challenge that we have to deal with is the one I raised at the beginning. They're going to rejoinder that, oh, look, if all that's happening here is that people are being discriminated against on the basis of whether they have the vaccine or not, and they're doing is being discriminated against with regard to being provided, you know, largesse or gratuitous privileges under statutory authority. These are not profound fundamental rights that you're entitled to. The key argument that needs to be made here is that the injection into one's body by this process, by state action, any type of involvement of the governments that are involved in this thing, inserting this type of information into your body, this messenger, this type of chip that you're talking about, this has to be focused upon as a key fact on which your case will rise or fall. The ability to show that this is being done here, this is what will mobilize the people into the streets. This is what will cause people to just dig in their heels and block the door when people come and try to offer them this vaccine. And it'll mobilize a massive movement that the other side has always proven but not able to deal with. If you have a mass movement that is rooted in fact, and there's no doubt about the fact that this elite group of people are constantly engaging in a conspiracy, that is designed to give them access to power, to give them access to control, to give them access to privilege, et cetera. All of these things are true. What we have to do is we have to have someone who's on our side, such as the Romero Institute, the Christic Institute historically, who is willing to assert this extremely unpopular position, but prove that it's true using all the mechanisms that are available within the legal system. Because one of the things that distresses me is so many of the lawsuits are kind of gastronomic, and they just throw it against the wall, and then they're defeated on the grounds of various technical legal problems that they haven't been careful enough about. That's one of the great reasons for having Robert Kennedy Jr. involved in this. He's had a great experience in history in the litigation of the River Keepers and others. There needs to be assembled an extremely capable team that is not not capable of being shamed, not being capable, you know, of being insulted or pushed aside, and just keep on coming, and have a very aggressive public education, grassroots organizing campaign if, in fact, these facts are ultimately established. And if the facts that you're asserting, Gary, if they can be shown to be true, then there is probably a cause of action that exists here. It's a more narrow cause of action that just has the right to have that chip taken out of this thing, have this chip taken out of here. If that's the fundamental underlying argument, you have that taken out. And then you have a secondary argument that, look, if these people are manipulating the facts and altering history and ignoring certain factual evidence simply because they want to get rich, which they historically do, you can also make that argument. It's a separate argument. It's an effective argument. It's not as gastronomically hysteria generating as the one about the chip. But the fact is, it's a legitimate argument that you're being manipulated just because they want to become, you know, billionaires, you know, whether it's Fauci or whoever else owns the patents here.
Danny, good. Let's let Mary address these. And Mary, this is also important. We focus all of our energy on vaccines. However, what about being forced to be tested without evidence that a person who is infected or shows physical signs of illness from a false PCR test? And also, what are our constitutional legal rights, not just being vaccinated, but also being tested or being deprived of promised government benefits, food stamps and housing, right, if poor, access to public transportation, schools, ability to get a driver's license or travel over state borders, et cetera. Please address that, Mary. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think, let me just go back for a moment. I don't think it's only about a secret chip. I think there's certainly patents that are out there that are creating IDs and quantum dot technology. And I think exactly you're right, Danny, that it's about what is the state action involved in this, and deep research and deep investigation needs to go behind a really undaunted legal team. And I agree that one can advance things and one can actually set things back if they're not done in a really thorough way. So I think, Gary, you're raising the question of sort of what about these deprivations of people's food and access, and to what extent is that legal? And I think actually this issue of no jab, no pay has been in the works in Australia for several years, and I'm aware that that is now in the process of being challenged, that people are not able to access public benefits, particularly child welfare payments, if they don't vaccinate their children. I think that will be very, very interesting to see how it plays out in Australia. Right now, in the United States, I do think that, you know, corporations, institutions are able to mandate vaccines. We just were involved in litigation against the University of California in mandating all of their faculty, staff, and students to get a flu vaccine, or they were risk losing their jobs, or they would have to work remotely, and it did allow religious and medical exemptions. We lost on the case. We may actually, it's not over yet, but initially we've lost. I think that the law, as it is interpreted right now, favors institutions being able to implement that. You know, Ticketmaster is saying we're not going to let people in if they don't show us. So the testing question is a very interesting one to me, Gary. I do think that there are real legal questions related to the tests that are available in the United States today, which we know are inaccurate, right? The PCR testing that's happening in the United States today, we know does not correlate in a precise or adequate way to infection status. And so what does a case mean? What does positive mean? We're looking at cases related to that, because I think that is a significant problem. But again, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission suggests that employers can ask for that kind of testing of their employees. So I find this area actually really problematic, because it does interfere with one's privacy. It can interfere with one's body. I mean, these tests are not entirely non-invasive, right? I mean, people can be harmed by these deep nasal swabs and so on. So I think this is really fairly new, this kind of testing and how pervasive it's very quickly become.
I agree. We're out of time. Thank you both very much. And we will continue to do in-depth original scholarly research reports showing you piece by piece how we can deconstruct the official narrative on COVID so we can deal with this realistically and in a healthy way. We've even written articles on how to prevent yourself from being immunocompromised to begin with. And there's no policy in America now to help people lose weight, and obesity is right up there as one of the number one and number two comorbidity factors for increasing a person's chance of getting sick with or dying with COVID. So we're on the wrong track on all levels. We'll try to share our information on a timely basis with all of you, and let us go forward together. Thank you both very much. Thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Nall.